Good morning and good afternoon as well for those of you on the other side of the Atlantic. I've talked before several times about getting my pilot's license and flight training, and one of the things that always sticks in my head was the very first flight lesson I took. I went to the airport in San Antonio, and on the backside of the airport, like most airports, there's a general aviation section. And, you know, most of us, we see the commercial aviation part of an airport where the airlines are and security checkpoints and the baggage claims and kind of the where the commercial airlines have all their presence. That's what most people see and think of when they go to an airport. But, you know, there's usually another side to the airport where there's cargo and small planes and general aviation. And so, you know, I found where that was on the other side of the airport and pulled up and went in and met the instructor who was going to be teaching me. And, you know, there's a lot of stuff going on. You get to walk out on the ramp. You're right beside the taxiways and the runways. And the particular place where I took lessons was just a couple of hangars down from the UPS and FedEx facilities. So there were constantly these giant cargo planes, L-1011s and 747s that were taxiing by, and it was pretty neat to be right there and get to see them. And we sat down and we talked about the lesson a little bit, and then we went and got in an airplane. And, you know, he was pointing things out and pointing to the dials and the gauges and the controls kind of, you know, talking me through everything and told me how to taxi and some of these different things. And then we started the plane up and taxied out, and he handled a lot of the radio calls. And sometimes he would say, you know, tell them this and talk to the tower and say this thing. And then, you know, when they would come back with an instruction, he'd make sure I knew what to do. And, you know, it was kind of fun. It was a little bit like driving a car. You steer with your feet, though, so it was a little bit different. Then we pull up and we get there at the edge of the runway, and he says, okay, now you're going to do this takeoff. And I was kind of thinking, what? You know, this is my first time in the pilot seat. And he said, yeah, you know, it's no problem. I'll be right here on the controls, you know, but you're going to do the takeoff. And when in a minute, they're going to clear you onto the runway, and they're going to say this and this. And, you know, they're going to tell you that you're cleared for takeoff, and they're going to give you a heading to fly after you take off. And you just repeat everything back to them. And then, you know, take us out to the middle of the runway and point it down the center line, and then go full throttle, and, you know, kind of walks through the steps. So, you know, the tower came on and gave us our clearance, taxied out there, pushed the throttle all the way in, speed starts building up. You know, he's telling me the gauges to look at and at the right point when to pull back on the yoke a little bit. And, you know, we take off and we're flying. And it was, I still remember it very clearly because it was very exciting and a really neat feeling to just kind of float off the runway and, you know, just kind of taking it all in and enjoying it. And that lasted for about 15 seconds before, you know, new instructions started coming in, and there was a big commercial airliner landing on the runway beside us, and, you know, there were planes circling around, and, you know, all of a sudden it went from just being a really cool feeling to being overwhelming. And, you know, as the flight instructor who had done this a lot of times, he kind of knew what I was going through, and he took over the radio and kind of gave me instructions on what to do. But I remember thinking then, man, this is a lot of stuff. You know, you got to watch what heading you're on. You got to watch your speed. You got to watch your rate of climb. You have to look out for other traffic, and you have other planes and controllers who are constantly talking in your ear. And I was just thinking, how am I going to make sense of all of this? But, you know, you go through the process and a lot of training, and eventually you understand which are the important things to focus on and how to filter out those important things from everything else that's going on around. And this is, you know, part of the flight training system and part of the technique that they use when they train all of the pilots. There's a big part of training that's called aeronautical decision making. And aeronautical decision making is a system that the airlines actually started to develop several decades ago to train their pilots. When flight first started, the most valuable skills were what they called stick and rudder, basically the ability to control the plane in flight and maneuver it around and land and, you know, do what you wanted. But as commercial airlines started and they started to track accidents and pay attention to what was going on, they saw that in almost all accidents, human factors were a major contributing cause. And so it came down to the decisions and the actions that people were taking versus mechanical failure or things that were out of the control of the pilots. So they did research into ways about how to analyze a situation, how to decide on the best path forward, how to reduce risk. And in the 80s, a lot of this became something that was standardized and turned into a very common part of pilot training. There's actually a study that the FAA did in the 80s, and it showed a 54% reduction in the accident rate for pilots who had had this kind of training in aeronautical decision making. So basically just training on how to make decisions and how to think would cut the accident rate almost in half, or actually over half, versus those that were just trained in how to control an airplane. And, you know, one of the things that the study reported was it said, contrary to popular opinion, good judgment can be taught. So, you know, it's something that they then made part of the required training for all pilots. Bad decisions in daily life, a lot of times they're not catastrophic, but in an airplane or in a vehicle speeding down the highway, there's less of a margin for error. And decisions do become really important, whether it's planning properly so you don't run out of gas, making sure you have the correct charts so you don't run into a mountain or a radio tower. You know, there's a lot of different factors that go into it. So aeronautical decision making is all about reducing risk, planning ahead, reducing fatigue and stress, and following a process to evaluate decisions carefully. I want to talk about one of the things that came out of this whole study and discipline of aeronautical decision making. It's called the five hazardous attitudes. One of the big areas that has an impact on pilot performance and on the way that we act is attitude, obviously. And in the studies that they did, they discovered kind of five common hazardous attitudes that pilots needed to be aware of and needed to control. And I think that, you know, they actually apply beyond just flying an airplane. They apply in other areas of our life. I want to read a couple of paragraphs from the Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge on the five hazardous attitudes. It says, being fit to fly depends on more than just a pilot's physical condition and recent experience. For example, attitude will affect the quality of decisions. Attitude is a motivational predisposition to respond to people, situations, or events in a given manner. Studies have identified five hazardous attitudes that can interfere with the ability to make sound decisions and exercise authority properly. Anti-authority, impulsivity, invulnerability, macho, and resignation. So those are the five. We'll go through them in a minute. Don't worry about trying to get them all. Hazardous attitudes contribute to poor pilot judgment, but can be effectively counteracted by redirecting the hazardous attitude so that correct action can be taken. Recognition of hazardous thoughts is the first step towards neutralizing them. After recognizing a thought as hazardous, the pilot should label it as hazardous and implement the corresponding antidote. So we're going to talk about the five hazardous attitudes today and their antidotes, and we'll see how it's something that isn't just useful if you're flying an airplane, but also useful in how we act in our daily lives and also in our Christian lives. So the first hazardous attitude is anti-authority. Anti-authority, and this is how it's defined. Anti-authority, quote-unquote, don't tell me. This attitude is found in people who do not like anyone telling them what to do. And probably at some point in our life, we all have that kind of an attitude or reaction where we don't want somebody else telling us what to do. In a sense, they are saying, quote, no one can tell me what to do. They may be resentful of having someone tell them what to do or may regard rules, regulations, and procedures as silly or unnecessary. However, it is always your prerogative to question authority if you feel it is an error. The antidote for that is to think, you know, follow the rules, they are usually right. So anti-authority. Let's turn over to Hebrews. This is definitely something that we can see a lot of today. Anti-authority. People don't like to have anyone telling them what to do, whether it's a spouse or a parent or a boss at work or the government of their town or state or country. We have a barber here that we go to, and he's a pretty funny character with a lot of stories, and he is definitely the kind of guy that doesn't like to be told what to do. But that's not always the right attitude that we should have. Here in Hebrews chapter 13 and verse 7, Paul talks about people who are in authority, especially in the church. Hebrews 13 verse 7, remember them which have the rule over you, who have spoken unto you the word of God, whose faith follow considering the end of their conversation. And then down in verse 17, He says again, obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls as they that must give account, that they may do it with joy and not with grief, for that is unprofitable for you. So in a sense, Paul here is saying, you know, follow the rules, respect those in charge because they're trying to watch out for you. And a lot of times that's even the case in the world. Most of the laws out there, like speed limits and building codes, are for our safety and protection. And it's something that there's not a lot of upside to saying, well, forget the speed limit. I'm going to drive however fast I want to drive, and I'm going to go 120 or 130 and don't care about the speed limit. I just saw that recently there's a video online that had gotten popular where there's a guy who posted a video in a Bugatti sports car that was doing something like 215 miles per hour. And some of the footage was in Arizona, and I think some of it was in Mexico, just on highways out there. But, you know, 215 miles per hour is about three times the what is normally, you know, the highest speed limit on the highway. And not a lot of time to react or respond to something that goes wrong when you're flying down the highway that fast. So, you know, that situation where that person obviously didn't want to be told what to do or how to drive their car. Let's go back to 1 Timothy. Paul says something else over here in 1 Timothy chapter 2, specifically about government. 1 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 1 says, I exhort therefore that first of all, supplications, prayers, intercessions, and giving of thanks be made for all men, and it continues in verse 2, for kings and for all that are in authority, that we may lead a quiet and peaceable life in godliness and honesty. So we should respect those in authority. We should also pray for them. We can pray that God uses them the way he wants to and that he helps them to make good decisions. So like it says here, you know, we can lead a peaceable life. We can lead a godly life in honesty. And also, you know, just so that they can be good rulers for everyone that they're over. 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter says something similar. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 13. 1 Peter 2 verse 13, submit yourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, whether it be to the king as supreme or unto governors as unto them that are sent by him, for the punishment of evildoers and for the praise of them that do well. For so is the will of God, that with well-doing you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. As free, and not using your liberty for a cloak of maliciousness, but as the servants of God. Honor all men, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the king. Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. So Peter here talks about those in government positions, talks about our bosses at work. We should honor them, we should show them respect. And then at the end he says, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward. And anyone who's worked for any period of time has probably had some good bosses and some not as good bosses. You know, maybe they're a boss that is, you know, just doesn't take care of their employees, or maybe they're a boss that's just kind of incompetent, and it can be hard to show them respect and put up with that. But, you know, that's what we're supposed to do, and we can pray about it. And any time that I've been in a situation like that, eventually it's resolved itself, and, you know, one way or another, and things have turned out okay. And in the end, you know, it's a lot better than acting in a way that ends up making you look bad and giving you a bad reputation. Like it says up in verse 15, for so is the will of God, that with well-doing you may put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. A lot of times, if you just keep doing what's right, persevere and endure through it, then the situation will resolve itself. God will intervene. He'll help out, and things will get a lot better. But one of the things about this, the anti-authority, when I read kind of the snippet from the Pilot's Handbook of Aeronautical Knowledge, the last sentence says, however, it is always your prerogative to question authority if you feel it is an error. Let's go over to Acts. After the church was started and the apostles would go around preaching, they definitely got into some trouble with authority. They didn't just cower down and refuse to do the work or refuse to do what God had commanded them to do, because in this case, you know, the authority was an error. And over here in Acts chapter 5 and verse 29, Peter sums it up pretty nicely. They had been put in prison and then they had been able to escape. They'd been able to leave, and then they went out to preach again, and they brought them back before the council and the high priest. And in verse 27, we can pick up the story in Acts 5, verse 27. And when they had brought them, they set them before the council, and the high priest asked them, saying, "Did not we straitly command you that you should not teach in this name? Behold, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us." Then Peter and the other apostles answered and said, "We ought to obey God rather than man." So, you know, if there's a conflict between the authority of the whatever authority we might be under, the human authority, and the authority of God, obviously God's authority supersedes that, and that's when this kind of hazardous attitude doesn't necessarily apply. That's what Peter says right here. We ought to obey God rather than man. So anti-authority, that's the first of the hazardous attitudes. The second one is impulsivity, being impulsive. This is the attitude of do it quickly. Impulsivity. This is the attitude of people who frequently feel the need to do something, anything, immediately. They do not stop to think about what they are about to do, they do not select the best alternative, and they do the first thing that comes to mind. We probably know people like this. There are some people who just never think, they're just constantly doing, taking action, and a lot of times they get a lot of stuff done, but it's not necessarily the right stuff, and there's a trail of havoc behind them as they proceed along. So the antidote to this is not so fast, think first. Just take a minute and think about what's going on. Let's turn over to James. James chapter 1. This applies in a lot of different areas in how we act on something, how we respond to a situation or to a confrontation or all sorts of things. We can be impulsive or we can just take a minute and think a little bit. James chapter 1 and verse 19. He says, "Wherefore, my beloved brethren, let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath." So James is kind of saying, you know, listen, think before you say something, before you get worked up and angry. Just slow down a little bit and think first. Verse 20, "For the wrath of man works not the righteousness of God." When we let our emotional reaction get the better of us or just react really quickly, a lot of times the outcome is not the best thing there. We know the story of Jephthah over in Judges chapter 11. I have to read the whole thing, but look at a couple of verses over in Judges chapter 11. Judges chapter 11 and verse 30. Some of the Israelites had come to Jephthah and asked him to help them in this battle. They were being attacked and they needed a leader, somebody who was going to be able to help them go to battle, and they came to Jephthah, and Jephthah made kind of a rash vow here in Judges 11, verse 30. "Jephthah vowed a vow unto the Lord and said, If you shall without fail deliver the children of Ammon into my hands, then it shall be that whatsoever comes forth of the doors of my house to meet me when I return in peace from the children of Ammon shall surely be the Lord's, and I will offer it up for a burnt offering." And we've talked about this before, how the translation here can be read in a few different ways, and for instance, my margin says at the end of verse 31, "It shall surely be the Lord's, or I will offer it up for a burnt offering," is alternative translation there instead of "and I will offer it up." But he goes out to battle and he's delivered. And then down in verse 34, he returns home. Judges 11, verse 34. "Jephthah came to Mizpah unto his house, and behold, his daughter came out to meet him with timbrels and with dances, and she was his only child. Beside her, he had neither son nor daughter. And it came to pass when he saw her that he rent his clothes and said, Alas, my daughter, you have brought me very low, and you are one of them that trouble me, for I have opened my mouth unto the Lord, and I cannot go back." And so, you know, he had made this vow, and he hadn't thought about what the possible consequences are, and he ended up having to dedicate his daughter to God. And, you know, it was something that, again, it was just a rash vow, and he could have taken a little bit of time and maybe said something more specific. Whatever animal or whatever clean animal, you know, just kind of thought it through a little bit more. And I've seen this a lot at work where people go into reaction mode. When we're running a bunch of computer systems and there starts to be a problem, some people immediately go into a mode where they just start trying to fix things. And it's understandable when the phones are ringing and customers are calling and they want to know what's going on, there's a lot of pressure to act quickly. But we usually try to implement a process where we ask, you know, what changed? Because something's running fine and working fine, and then it stops working fine. Something along the way changed. And so, you know, what changed? Try to figure out what the right action to take is. It's just too easy to react, and seen a lot of times where those initial actions end up making things worse, and then you have to unravel this whole chain of quote-unquote fixes that made the situation worse. So this hazardous attitude, the antidote is, before you make any kind of decision that can have permanent consequences, think about those impacts. You know, if it's going to be a big decision in your life, think about the possible outcomes, think about the alternatives, get counsel on it, weigh it out, count the costs, make sure that you don't just impulsively decide, you know, you're going to quit your job or move across the country or do something that can really have far-reaching and permanent impact. And that's, you know, really how you can handle this hazardous attitude. The third hazardous attitude is invulnerability. It won't happen to me. Invulnerability. Many people falsely believe that accidents happen to others, but never to them. They know accidents can happen, and they know that anyone can be affected. However, they never really feel or believe that they will personally be involved. Pilots who think this way are more likely to take chances and increase risk. And this is also probably an attitude that a lot of people have at some point in their life, probably when they're younger. I know that I can think back to when I was younger, and it wasn't that long ago, but there were definitely things that I look back on now and I go, man, what was I thinking? You just think, oh, it's not going to be a problem. I can do this. Nothing's going to happen. But the reality is that a lot of times that attitude is directly the cause of an accident down the road. The antidote for this is to think it could happen to me. That's something to remember. That's an attitude that a lot of times comes into play when things become routine. If something becomes routine, we get complacent. Things like driving. I drive a lot, and it can get to be really commonplace, especially if you're just traveling the same route and, you know, you stop paying attention and you're thinking and you're kind of on autopilot and you realize, oh, you know, I'm 10 miles down the road and you haven't paid attention to the other traffic around you and the squirrels and the dogs that are running across the road or whatever it might be. And you just think, you know, I drive this road every day. Nothing's going to happen. It can happen in a lot of areas. We can have a job that is dangerous in some way, and we know we go there every day to this location, and we take the same actions every day, and we follow the same processes, and we just stop paying attention and end up putting ourselves in a situation where when something happens, we're not prepared to act for it. We have 3 horses, and when we first started with these horses, they were not that trained. When we spent a lot of time training them and getting them to be pretty well behaved and getting them to a place where we had a reasonable amount of control over them. And about a year ago, you know, after we'd been working with them and they were pretty good, we had visitors who were at the house and we were out walking one morning in the pasture, and something that we did a lot, and we were out just kind of playing around with the horses and scratching on them and giving them some attention. And I was scratching on the side of Shelby, who's the biggest one. She's kind of a brown color. And, it's just something that we did a lot. And I wasn't paying super close attention to her. And she kind of started to walk away. And then I just glanced over and I saw her kind of drop her head and pin her ears back against her head. And I thought, uh-oh. And I hopped backwards out of the way just as she kicked out one of her rear legs. And she caught me on my leg. And it was, it was kind of a glancing blow because I was dodging. But, it left a big bruise there. I had a hoof-shaped bruise for over a week. And, you know, that was something that we'd done almost every day for a while, just go hang out with them. And I'd gotten complacent and I wasn't paying attention. She was telling me that she didn't want me there, but I just, you know, wasn't paying enough attention. We're all much more comfortable with each other now, and nothing else like that really has happened since then. But I'm definitely very aware of whatever signals they're sending. They can have a day where they're not feeling well or where they're grumpy and, you know, they're really fast. So you got to pay attention and stay aware of what's going on. And just on and on, the things that we do over and over, a lot of times we take for granted and we think, oh, nothing's going to happen to me. But we have to stay aware and pay attention to what's going on. And this is true in our spiritual life as well. We can get used to situations or to people or to things that, you know, are not good for us, and we don't realize it, but we just kind of accept it and stay there and keep getting pulled deeper and deeper in. Let's go over to 1 Corinthians chapter 9. 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verse 24. 1 Corinthians 9 and verse 24. Know you not that they which run in a race run all, but one receives the prize? So run that you may obtain. And every man that strives for the mastery is temperate in all things. Now they do it to obtain a corruptible crown, but we an incorruptible. Paul's talking here about what our goal is. We want that incorruptible crown. Verse 26, I therefore so run, not as uncertainly, so fight I, not as one that beats the air, but I keep under my body. He disciplines himself. He works on building self-control and bring it into subjection, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. So this is the Apostle Paul, who wrote all of these books in the Bible here. He wrote all of these letters. He was the apostle to the Gentiles and a major leader and took the gospel all over. And he says that, you know, he still was working on being disciplined and on building character. And why? You know, did he think, oh, I've got it made. You know, nothing's going to happen to me. I'm set. You know, he says, lest that by any means, when I have preached to others, I myself should be a castaway. Or New King James says disqualified. He knew that it could happen to him if he wasn't careful, if he didn't stay on top of his game and continue to work. 2 Peter chapter 2. 2 Peter chapter 2 and verse 20. 2 Peter 2 verse 20. Peter is talking here about those who start to fall away or who start to teach error. 2 Peter 2 verse 20. For if after they have escaped the pollutions of the world through the knowledge of the Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, they are again entangled therein and overcome, the latter end is worse with them than the beginning. For it had been better for them not to have known the way of righteousness than after they have known it to turn from the holy commandment delivered unto them. But it has happened unto them according to the true proverb, the dog is turned to his own vomit again, and the sow that was washed to her wallowing in the mire. You know, it's something that can happen, and we've all seen it. We've all seen it happen with people that we know, sometimes people in our family, people that we went to church with for years and years, ministers. It really can happen, and we have to stay on our guard and stay aware of that. We can't think, well, you know, it won't happen to me. We have to think it could happen to me, and then take the action that's necessary to prevent it from happening. So that's the third attitude there, invulnerability. The fourth one is macho. This is the attitude of, you know, I can do it. Maybe there's something that people say can't be done, and, you know, this is, you go, well, yeah, well, I can. Macho. Pilots who are always trying to prove that they are better than anyone else think, I can do it, I'll show them. Pilots with this type of attitude will try to prove themselves by taking risks in order to impress others. While this pattern is thought to be a male characteristic, women are equally susceptible. And that's an attitude that a lot of people have, I think, especially competitive people. They want to impress others. They want to prove that they can do something that, you know, is difficult that other people can't do. And they'll go too far in trying to prove their point. The antidote for this attitude is taking chances is foolish. And I think there are times to take chances. There are times when it's not foolish, but that's when you need to exercise that other antidote about think first before you act. You need to say, okay, does it have a potential for having a really long-reaching impact? Is it something where the consequences are irreversible? You know, in the context of flight, a lot of times the consequences can be irreversible. You know, it's not worth trying to stretch your fuel a little bit and make it to the original airport instead of stopping and getting gas at a closer airport. Or it's not worth trying to land in weather that's bad and you aren't sure if you can operate the plane in those kinds of conditions. It's better to go somewhere else where the weather's clear or the wind is calm and you don't have to try to push it. When I was actually taking my flight test and going through, you do a bunch of maneuvers, fly around, navigate, all this kind of thing, and then you do landings at the end. And the airport that the examiner had directed me to go to do my landings was having really gusty winds. And I circled around and got into the traffic pattern, and the plane's bouncing around a lot. And you can hear a report from the airport that tells you what the winds are. And so I listened to that, and it sounded like it was reasonable and within something that I was comfortable with, and go through the flight pattern lineup for final approach on the runway. And some coming down, there were hangars on one side of the runway, and the wind would blow around those. It was really gusty and start to get lower and lower, and the plane was just pitching around a lot, and it was really hard to hold it in line. So I put the throttle all the way in and did a go around, and you know, went back up and circled around and was going to come in for another landing. And then they updated the weather report from the airport. It was usually every 5 or 10 minutes is when it would start broadcasting the new report, and the winds were actually a lot stiffer than the one that I had heard originally. I think it was gusting close to 30 or 35 knots, so that's about 35 or 40 miles per hour, which is a lot of wind. So, you know, we talked about it, and I said, oh, if I were just flying this as a flight, I wouldn't try to land here. And he said, well, that's fine. You know, we can defer the landings, and we'll come back and finish that part of the flight test later. So that was what we ended up doing. And, you know, I think that was the right decision in that case. My flight instructor was telling me about another student that had tried to, because I went and talked to him about it, and he said that that airport, the way the hangars are and the way the wind comes, there are really strong gusts that come there. And he told me about another student that was there that had actually done something similar and tried to land at that airport and ended up in the cornfield off to the other side of the runway because the wind, you know, gusted just as he was about to land and caught the plane and just carried it right over. He was fine and the plane was fine, but not the most desirable outcome to end up in the cornfield. Had to get a tractor out there to tow the plane up, and I think had to replace one of the landing gear. If we're going to take a chance, we need to think, well, what are the consequences of this? You know, is it something that's reversible, or is it something that we can't recover from and we really shouldn't take that chance? And the other thing to remember, too, is just that at the end of the day, it's not really worth it because there's nothing that we can do that's really that impressive. When we think about, you know, what we actually are as humans, we can't really do anything that's that amazing. And even just among humans, you know, there's always somebody who's faster or taller or stronger or smarter or richer or better looking or whatever, and wasting a bunch of time and taking dangerous chances to prove ourselves really is pointless. Let's go over to Job. Job was pretty successful in his day. He was righteous, but he was also self-righteous. And you get the feeling that he kind of had, maybe had this attitude of, you know, well, I can do it. I've done a lot of stuff and I'm a pretty good guy. But through the book of Job, his attitude changes. He kind of starts to realize that he isn't that much. There's not that much for him to be proud of. Job chapter 42 and verse 1. Job chapter 42 and verse 1. Then Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do everything and that no thought can be withheld from you. That's an important realization. If we know that and if we accept that God can do anything and that, you know, there's nothing that he doesn't know, nothing that he isn't able to do, then it puts our abilities and our life into a better perspective. You know, that's really the first key to having humility, is to understanding how great God is, and then, you know, we understand how small and puny we are. Verse 3, who is he that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore have I uttered that I understood not, things too wonderful for me which I knew not. And so, you know, in a way, up to this point, Job kind of had this macho attitude of, you know, what? Look at me, what have I done? Why would I've done this and this and this. What have I done wrong? Why would all of these bad things be coming on someone like me? And, you know, here that starts to get cleaned up and wiped away. Verse 4, "Here I beseech you, and I will speak. I will demand, or I will question you, and declare you unto me." Verse 5, "I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you." Job had knowledge of God, obviously, and says that he was righteous, but he didn't necessarily have the deepest understanding. And that through this ordeal that he had gone through and everything that had happened to him, it had knocked him down a notch, helped him to see himself in a better perspective and a more correct perspective, and he now had better understanding. And then you can see here in verse 6 the result of that. "Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." So, you know, he really had quite a change there from some of the beginning parts of the book of Job, where he talks about being ready to defend himself, and, you know, he would love to hear the accusation against him, and he was ready to take anyone on who wanted to question his righteousness. And, you know, now he says, "I've heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Wherefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." That's part of the antidote to this as well. It's just remembering what we are and how incapable we are of doing anything. And if there was ever a human who was capable of doing something, it would have been Christ. But he even had this attitude over in John chapter 5. John chapter 5 and verse 30. John 5 verse 30. "I can of my own self do nothing. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just, because I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father which has sent me." So there's a lot of stuff in that verse there. Christ says that on his own, he can't do anything. And if Christ couldn't do anything on his own, then we are certainly in that same boat of not being able to do anything on our own. But I think the other part of it, too, is that's important. You know, we talk about that a lot, but at the end he says, "I seek not my own will, but the will of the Father which has sent me." And again, that's part of that humility and part of the antidote to this macho attitude. If what you care about is not your own will, not trying to impress others or prove yourself or show how grand you are, what you're interested in is God's will and doing what he wants you to do, then it makes all of that other stuff a lot less important and a lot less interesting, and, you know, something that you're not going to go take a bunch of foolish risks and chances for. So macho, that's the fourth hazardous attitude. The fifth hazardous attitude is resignation. Resignation. "What's the use? Pilots who think, 'What's the use?' do not see themselves as being able to make a great deal of difference in what happens to them. When things go well, the pilot is apt to think that it is good luck. When things go badly, the pilot may feel that someone is out to get me or attribute it to bad luck. The pilot will leave the action for others, for better or worse. Sometimes such pilots will even go along with unreasonable requests just to be a quote-unquote nice guy." So when you resign or submit your resignation, you're quitting. And that's kind of what this attitude is about. It's, you know, I'm not really going to put any effort into it. Things are going to happen however they happen, or they've already happened and I can't do anything about it. This is really the kind of the opposite of the impulsivity. You know, instead of just acting quickly without thinking, it's not taking any action at all. And the antidote for resignation is to think, "I'm not helpless, I can make a difference." And that's something that it's an important antidote to have, because we'll all get into situations where things are tough and where we just go, "Man, doesn't seem like anything I do is helping, anything I do is having any kind of an impact, and what's the point?" And kind of get into that attitude of resignation. You have to realize that you can make a difference, that things don't just have to happen to you, and it comes down to perseverance. We've talked about perseverance and endurance and other things a lot. You know, as we go through trials, there's sickness and there are job problems or family problems or whatever it might be. It can get really tough to stick with it and to persevere and to not just get depressed and despondent. The antidote for that is to think about, well, what can I do? What can I do that's going to help the situation, that's going to make some kind of improvement? And I'm going to go act on that and do my part and then put the rest of it in God's hands and let him take care of it. Let's go over to Philippians chapter 4. Philippians chapter 4. So we just read where Christ said that he couldn't do anything on his own. Paul here, he writes an interesting kind of the corollary to that. In Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13, I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me. So we can't do anything on our own, but if we look to Christ for strength, then we see that we can do anything. We can get through anything. We can overcome any kind of situation. And we can, you know, endure and persevere through whatever may come along. One of the things that was kind of fun in flight training, they had a simulator. And so for the first part of flight training, usually you would do a flight in the simulator and then go fly the same lesson in an actual airplane. And it was probably a lot less frightening for the flight instructors to do it that way. You'd go in and you'd practice turns and you practice climbs and stalls and all of this in the flight simulator, and then you'd go in an airplane and do it. And the flight simulator set up, you had chairs that were like the airplane, you had all the controls like the airplane, they had a set of TV screens that wrapped around you, and so it looked, you know, basically like the view that you would have out of the airplane. And, you know, you would get to practice a lot of things there. And the other thing that was really neat about it is they could practice things in the simulator that you hopefully would never actually have to do in an airplane. Once you get a couple of lessons in, they start working on emergency procedures. And then they just constantly drill you on emergency procedures. We'd be on a flight and the instructor would reach over and basically cut the throttle all the way back and say, you just lost your engine. What are you going to do now? Or he'd say, you know, there's a fire in the right wing. What are you going to do now? Or, you know, all sorts of just anything like that he'd throw out, and you know, you just have to go through the emergency procedure, and they drill it into you over and over, so it just becomes a natural reaction that happens. But one of the things that they could do in the simulators, they had, you know, the flight deck there, and then there's a computer console that the flight instructor would sit at, and he had controls where he could do all sorts of things to the plane and give you all sorts of systems failures. And so, you know, he'd kill my electrical system, so some of my gauges would, you know, die and I wouldn't have certain information. Or he'd make the weather get really bad all of a sudden. Or he did fires, he did engine failures, he did overheating. And then there was one particular lesson where he just started giving me failure after failure. It was a fire, and then, you know, with a fire, you turn your engine off, and then the engine wouldn't restart. And then he started to have pieces of the plane come off. He just started, you know, like breaking pieces of the plane off. Eventually, I lost both my wings and ended up crashing, but, you know, it was fine because it was just a simulator. But, you know, the point was, what he told me was, he said, you have to learn these procedures so that they're just the natural reaction. And then he said, you just have to, you know, keep running through them. And sometimes something will go wrong and then something else will go wrong. And the phrase that he used is, he said, you have to fight it all the way down. And so, you know, you don't give up. Don't say, oh, well, you know, that's it. I'm helpless now and I can't do anything else. Because if you read through aviation history, there are a lot of, there actually is a really interesting set of accidents and things where pilots have done that and overcome crazy things, structural failure in their airplanes, the rudder of the airplane coming off, things like this. So, you know, that's one of those things that they want to ingrain in you, is that, you know, you're going to fight it all the way down. You're going to keep working on it, and you're going to persevere and stick with it and not just give up. And that's what we have to do in other parts of our life as well. And Paul gives us the key here. I can do all things through Christ which strengthens me, there in Philippians chapter 4 and verse 13. If we go over to 1 Peter again, he addresses this as well. 1 Peter chapter 2. This is something else that I've seen at work. Since we run these systems that are supposed to be online all the time, you know, when they start to fail or have issues, then everybody pitches in and starts to work on it. And sometimes they're really complex systems. They will have thousands of servers and networking devices and literally millions of users who are trying to actively use these systems. And so there's a lot of stuff going on. And then at the same time, you have hackers and people who are trying to cause problems on the system and bring it down. And we've had situations where, you know, we've been working for hours or even days, and, you know, it's tough to keep going, but you just have to stick with it and keep pushing on it. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 19. Sometimes we go through these things because of the way we live our life. 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 19, "For this is thankworthy, if a man for conscience toward God endure grief, suffering wrongly." And the New King James says it's commendable. Sometimes that happens. Sometimes we have to endure grief or trials or persecution because of the way that we want to live our life. "For what glory is it if when you be buffeted for your faults, you shall take it patiently? But if when you do well and suffer for it, you take it patiently, this is acceptable with God. For even hereunto were you called, because Christ also suffered for us, leaving us an example that you should follow his steps." You know, think about how Christ lived his life, and especially as we come towards Passover, you know, the end of his life. He knew what was coming, and he knew what was going to happen, and it was something that he knew was not going to be pleasant, but he also wanted, like he said before, you know, he wanted to do the will of his Father, and so he stuck with it and endured through all of the persecution and the torture and the crucifixion. And as this antidote says, you know, "I'm not helpless, I can make a difference." He certainly made a difference. He made the biggest difference that anyone has ever made in the history of humanity. You know, that's the kind of attitude that we need to have there. You know, stick with it, you know, fight it all the way down, realize we can make a difference. And, you know, yes, it'll be tough, and sometimes it'll take a while to get through it, but don't just sit back and let life happen to you, so to speak. So those are the five hazardous attitudes there: anti-authority, impulsivity, invulnerability, macho, resignation. That's one of the components of the coursework that you end up doing on aeronautical decision making. There are other pieces of it around how to have a very logical process for evaluating information and then trying to choose the best course of action. There are other things that go into it around planning ahead of time and taking care of yourself and making sure you're fit to fly and all of this kind of thing. But I think that the hazardous attitudes are one piece that is really applicable outside of flying airplanes, because in our life, we're constantly running into situations that we don't foresee, things that come up that are unexpected or, you know, that are painful or that we have to figure out how to deal with. And, you know, sometimes the natural reaction that we have is to fall into one of these attitudes and to start to feel helpless, or, you know, to go to the other extreme and feel invulnerable and like you can just do whatever you want to do and there aren't going to be any consequences. But, you know, these are important attitudes to be aware of. You know, our attitudes, they have a huge impact on our lives. That can be a positive impact or a negative impact. The attitude that we have definitely affects how we view situations. It affects how we react and how we make decisions. And so, you know, even though we might be predisposed to certain types of attitudes just because of our personality or the people around us or the circumstances we're in or how we were raised or, you know, what side of the bed we woke up on that day, there are all sorts of things that can affect just kind of the natural attitude we might have. We have to realize that, you know, we can have an impact on them and change them. Let's turn over to 2 Corinthians. One final verse here over in 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 5. Verse 5. "Casting down imaginations and every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, and bringing into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ." That last phrase there is what I want to focus on. Bring into captivity every thought to the obedience of Christ. You could say, bring every attitude into captivity to the obedience of Christ. Attitudes don't just happen to us. We may find ourselves in an attitude, but then when we recognize one of these five hazardous attitudes or other negative attitudes, then we can stop, we can acknowledge it, we can think of an antidote, and then turn that attitude around. And if we're able to do that, then it will have a very positive impact on our life and the decisions we make and how we live it.